All right, so we're diving into some pretty dense legal territory today. It looks like we're tackling Bieber v. Hospital Corp. America.
That's right, a case that really unpacks some of the core principles and, honestly, some of the limitations of EMTALA.
EMTALA, for anyone just joining us, that's the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. You'll probably also hear it called the Anti-Dumping Law.
And that nickname gets right to the heart of it. It was passed back in 1986 to stop hospitals from turning away patients in need of emergency care just because they couldn't pay.
Not about the quality of care, but about making sure everyone has that baseline access to emergency services.
Absolutely. And it lays out two main duties for hospitals. They have to do a proper medical screening to figure out if someone has an emergency medical condition. And if they do, they got to stabilize that patient before they can transfer them somewhere else.
So Bieber gives us a really interesting lens to look at how those EMTALA duties actually play out in a real-world situation. And this one is, well, pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah, it really gets you thinking about the complexities of emergency care and the legal framework that tries to ensure fairness and safety.
Exactly. So shall we get into the specifics of the Bieber case?
Let's do it.
Okay, so we're going back to August of 1987. Brenda Bieber arrives at the ER, Raleigh General Hospital. Right away, it's clear this isn't going to be simple. She's agitated, showing psychiatric symptoms, and the question of whether she might be pregnant.
Right off the bat, the ER staff is dealing with multiple layers of potential issues.
And it gets even more complicated when you factor in that Brenda had stopped taking her antipsychotic medication and had been drinking.
Oh, yeah, that definitely adds a whole other dimension to the situation. Potential interactions, withdrawal effects, all on top of her already distressed state.
So the ER physician, Dr. Klein, he examines Brenda and orders some lab work. But while they're waiting for those results, she's understandably upset moving around the ER.
It's a tense situation, you can imagine.
Totally. So Dr. Klein gives her some sedatives, trying to calm her down. Doesn't quite work as well as hoped, though. And then, just after midnight, she has a seizure and falls, hitting her head on a table.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, pretty bad fall. She ends up with a cut on her scalp.
So now, on top of everything else, they have a potential head injury to deal with.
Absolutely. Now, Dr. Klein, he stitches up the cut. His notes say she could talk, move her head, eyes, limbs, oxygen levels good.
Sounds like a pretty thorough check.
Yeah, but she's still disoriented. So Dr. Klein talks with Brenda's psychiatrist, and they figure the seizure was probably tied to her psychiatric issues. They decide to transfer her to the psych unit at Beckley Appalachian Regional Hospital.
And this is where things get really tricky from a legal perspective, because as we'll find out, Brenda needed a neuro assessment, and that didn't happen before the transfer.
Yeah. Did Raleigh General do what they were supposed to under EMTALA before they sent her off? Did they screen her properly? Was she stable enough to be moved? These are the questions that come up.
Huge questions, because unfortunately, after she gets to Beckley Appalachian, she has another seizure, a much worse one. This time, they do a CT scan. And what do they find? A fractured skull and a subdural hematoma.
Basically, a very serious brain bleed.
Exactly. And it seems like that injury was missed back at Raleigh General.
It's just awful. She has to be transferred back to Raleigh General, but this time she's in a coma and she dies the next day.
Tragic outcome.
It really is. So naturally, Brenda's brother, acting for her estate, he files a lawsuit.
Makes sense. You've got potential negligence, potential violations of federal law.
Yeah, the lawsuit names pretty much everyone, Dr. Klein, another doctor, both hospitals, even my parent companies, the claim. Violations of EMTALA.
A whole lot of legal fingers being pointed.
So before we get to how the courts handled all of that, let's zoom in on the legal nitty-gritty here. What were the big picture questions the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals had to sort out when the case landed on their desk?
Three major things, really. First, can you actually sue individual doctors under EMTALA? Second, did Raleigh General mess up their EMTALA duties, you know, the appropriate medical screening and stabilized requirements? And third, did Beckley Appalachian have any responsibility under EMTALA, seeing as Brenda was admitted directly to their psych unit, not through their ER?
Okay, let's break those down one by one. First up, can you go after individual doctors using EMTALA? What did the court say?
Pretty clear answer on that one. No, you can't. The Fourth Circuit said EMTALA doesn't give individuals the right to directly sue the doctors involved.
Interesting. So if I'm understanding this right, EMTALA is more about holding the hospital itself accountable, not singling out specific doctors.
That's the gist of it. They pointed to the language of the law, which puts the responsibility squarely on the hospitals. They even looked back at the discussions that happened when Congress was putting EMTALA together, and it seems they talked about including doctors, but ultimately decided not to.
So they were very deliberate about that choice.
Yeah, the thinking was that you already have state medical malpractice laws to deal with claims against individual doctors if they screw up. EMTALA was supposed to tackle the bigger problem of hospitals just refusing to treat people who couldn't pay.
Makes sense. Different tools for different problems.
Exactly. So the court upheld the decision to dismiss Dr. Klein from the EMTALA part of the lawsuit.
Okay, so that clears up the doctor question. MTAL is more about influencing how hospitals operate, not about second-guessing individual medical decisions.
That's a good way to put it.
All right, next question then. Did Raleigh General fail those two big MTALA duties, providing an appropriate medical screening and making sure Brenda was stabilized before transferring her? What did the court have to say about those?
This is where things get a little nuanced. Let's start with the appropriate medical screening duty. The court actually said Raleigh General didn't violate MTAL on that one.
Really? Even though they missed the head injury?
Yeah, and this is key. MTAL doesn't say a hospital has to get the diagnosis right every time. It's not about perfection.
So it's not about a national one-size-fits-all standard for what a perfect emergency screening looks like.
Right. Instead, MTALA says each hospital has to use its own internal rules for screening patients, and they have to apply those rules fairly and consistently to everyone who comes in with similar problems.
So basically, if they have a system, they have to stick to it no matter who the patient is.
You got it. And the court decided that Raleigh General did actually screen Brenda. Dr. Klein, he examined her, ordered tests, did a physical assessment, and that lined up with their usual way of handling patients like her.
So tragic as the outcome was, the court is saying missing the subdural hematoma, that might be medical negligence, a state law issue, but it's not automatically a failure to screen under MTALA.
Exactly. MTALA is about the process, not necessarily the result. It's saying, did they follow their own rules, not did they magically know everything that was wrong?
Okay, I see the distinction there. Now, what about stabilizing Brenda before the transfer? What'd the court say about that part?
Well, this is where Baber gets really interesting and, to be honest, a little controversial. The court said that a hospital's duty to stabilize an emergency medical condition only kicks in if they actually know about that condition.
Wait, so if they don't realize someone has a serious problem, they don't have to stabilize it?
That's essentially what the Baber court decided, and they were very specific about it. They called it actual knowledge. The hospital has to be aware of the specific emergency condition. In Brenda's case, they were focused on her psychiatric issues. They didn't realize she had this severe head injury.
So even though the head injury was there, even though it was ultimately what killed her, they didn't know about it, so they weren't obligated to stabilize it under MTALA.
That's how the court saw it, looking back and saying, oh, they should have known, that's not enough for an MTALA violation.
Wow. So it's not about what they should have known, but what they actually knew at that moment? That's a really important point.
It is, and it means MTALA's role in all this might be more about stopping hospitals from knowingly transferring patients who are unstable, rather than making sure every diagnosis is perfect.
Right, right. It's about preventing a hospital from saying, oh, this patient is unstable, but they can't pay, so let's send them somewhere else.
That's the core of it.
Okay, so we've covered two of those big legal questions. What about the third one, Beckley Appellation's possible liability? Brenda went straight to their psych unit, skipped the ER entirely. Did they have to do an MTALA screening?
Nope, the court said they didn't. They were very clear that MTALA's screening requirement only applies when someone specifically goes to the emergency department.
So if you come in through a different door, even if you have a medical emergency, MTALA might not apply.
Based on Baber, that seems to be the case. It's all about where you initially show up at the hospital.
So to sum up, MTALA hinges a lot on that first point of contact. If it's not the ER, the hospital's obligations might be different.
That's the takeaway here, yeah.
All right, to make sure we're crystal clear on what came out of Baber, let's lay it out. What does someone actually have to prove to win an MTALA case based on this ruling? Like, if they're saying a hospital failed the screening duty, what do they need to show?
Two main things, really. First, they got to prove that the hospital had specific procedures for screening patients with symptoms like theirs. Second, they got to prove the hospital didn't follow those procedures in their case, meaning they were treated differently than someone else with similar symptoms.
So it's about showing there was a system in place and they didn't follow it for you.
Right, with the implication being that the reason they didn't follow it might be because of your ability to pay or lack thereof.
Okay, that makes sense. And what about proving a violation of the stabilization duty? What needs to be shown there?
A few more elements to this one. First, you have to show you actually had an emergency medical condition. Second, you got to prove the hospital knew about that condition, that actual knowledge thing we talked about. Third, you have to show they didn't stabilize you before transferring you. And finally, if you were unstable when they transferred you, they either didn't get your informed consent for the transfer or they didn't follow the proper procedures for certifying and documenting the transfer.
So much of this seems to come down to that actual knowledge element. That seems like a really difficult thing to prove.
It can be, because even if you had a serious medical problem that led to bad outcomes, if the hospital can convince a court they didn't know about it at the time, they might be off the hook under MTALA.
It's all about what they knew in that moment, not what they should have known.
Exactly. And the Baber court was really insistent on that. They said MTALA is about stopping discrimination, not about being a federal medical malpractice law.
Right. So MTALA is more about access to care than about the quality of that care once you're in the system.
That's a good way to think about it.
Okay, so let's step back and look at the big picture. Why is Baber v. Hospital Corp. America still such a big deal when we're talking about Imtella? What are its lasting impacts?
Well, Baber really drew some pretty clear lines in the sand when it comes to what Imtella can and can't do. First, it said, definitively, doctors can't be directly sued under Imtella. It's the hospital that's on the hook.
So it's about changing the system, not punishing individual mistakes.
Right. Second, Baber said what counts as an appropriate medical screening is determined by the hospital's own policies and practices, not some ideal national standard.
So it's not about what the best screening would look like, but about whether the hospital followed its own rules.
Exactly. And third, Baber said Imtella's screening requirement is mostly focused on what happens in the ER, not other parts of the hospital. If you're admitted someone else, different rules might apply.
Makes sense. But, you know, thinking about this, it seems like there could be a problem if a hospital's own standards for screening are pretty low. Doesn't that create a loophole where they could miss serious stuff and not get in trouble under Imtella?
That's a valid concern. The worry is that hospitals could set a low bar for themselves and then escape Imtella liability even when they mess up.
Right, because the legal standard becomes, did you follow your own potentially inadequate rules, not did you do what a reasonably competent medical professional would do?
Exactly. But the court in Baber was pretty clear that Imtella wasn't meant to replace state medical malpractice laws. Those laws are supposed to deal with cases where doctors or hospitals just don't provide competent care.
So it's two separate systems, each with its own purpose.
That's how the courts see it. Imtella is about preventing discrimination in access to emergency care, not about setting a national standard for medical practice.
So for everyone listening, understanding Baber v. Hospital Corp., America is like having a cheat sheet for how Imtella works and where it falls short. You now know that Imtella's power is mainly aimed at hospitals, not individual doctors. You've also seen how an appropriate medical screening is judged against the hospital's own playbook, not some perfect ideal. And you know that this screening duty is usually triggered at the ER door, not necessarily anywhere else in the hospital. Plus, that crucial stabilized requirement that only comes into play if the hospital knows there's an emergency condition.
Really important stuff to keep in mind.
It really is, and it all leads to a really big question. If Imtella isn't a catch-all for medical negligence, how does that affect patients' rights when things go wrong in an emergency? How do you get justice if a hospital misses a diagnosis but followed its own potentially flawed procedures? These are things worth thinking about.
Absolutely. And there's a whole other layer to this. Some states have passed what they call Imtella Plus's laws, which go above and beyond the federal rules. That's definitely something to look into.
Yeah, good point. So for all our listeners out there, until their hymns deep dive, keep those tears turning, Baber gives us a lot to chew on, both legally and ethically. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.